listening nightly to our favorite shows. Radio, oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you so.
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear. A look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Time once again to settle into your favorite easy chair for another hour of vintage radio. Later on, it's William Gargan starring in Barry Craig, Investigator. But first, on the lighter side, it's the Bob Hope Show. Bob Hope came to radio in a ready-made program premiering on the NBC Blue Network in January of 1935 called The Intimate Review. Then movies beckoned. He was featured in the big broadcast of 1938, and one of the songs from that film, Thanks for the Memory, would become famous as his theme when his Pepsodent program opened on NBC in September of 1938. By 1943, Hope's program topped all programs with a whopping hooper of 40+. The program featured guest stars, including that of Al Jolson, Dorothy L'Amour, Eddie Cantor, Bing Crosby, and many, many others. Even before America's entry into World War II, Hope had given more than 500 free performances for servicemen. By the end of the war, Newsweek reported that Hope had appeared at almost every camp, naval base, and hospital in the country. Return with us now to those exciting days of yesteryear with The Bob Hope Show and special guest star Jack Benny from November of 1948. Another classic show from the golden age of radio here on Yesteryear.
Major Bowes, I miss the shadow notes, Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern, Helen Trent, oh, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Merton Mar, Jameis, and Andy. I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you. Sodio, vodio, dodio, do. Radio, I miss you so.
Yes, it's the new Swan Show with our great singing star, Doris Day. A new singing favorite, Bill Farrell.
That's me.
Our guest, Jack Benny, Irene Ryan, the Four Hits and a Miss, the new Les Brown Band.
We use Swan exclusively. How about you?
Yes, how about you?
Who, me? My name is Robert Hopalong Hope.
And now, Bob Hope's view of the news. Princeton, New Jersey. Hurried conferences and frantic alibis were the order of the day here as the nation's poll takers sought to explain a disastrous error in predicting the results of last week's election.
Dr. Gallup was amazed at the outcome, but he wouldn't admit he was wrong. Last night, he was still peeking into the White House window and singing, "Maybe You'll Be There." He was really unhappy. When he saw the election returns, he exclaimed, "It's the last time I take a house-to-house survey. From now on, I'm going to ask people." I called up Elmer Roper and said, "How can your predictions be so wrong?" He said, "You see, we mathematicians make a prodigious effort to ascertain by statistical and prognostication and political prestidigitation the approximate parallelisms." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Where can I get a job?" Tuesday night, Drew Pearson said over the radio, "I predict Dewey will be elected by 10:30. At 11 o'clock, he said, "I predict Dewey." At 12, he said, "I predict." The next morning, he said, "Ay, ay, 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 ay."
New York, New York. Phone company executives announced here today that telephones for automobiles were at long last ready and available for Mr. Average Motorist.
I had a phone put in my car last week, but the wires must be crossed. Every time I step on the starter, the spark plugs give a busy signal, and the receiver squirts a quart of hot oil in my ear. But they're a big help to the motorist. If a guy's speeding, he can look in the rear vision mirror, see a cop trailing him, call his lawyer, and the three of them can meet at the next intersection. But think what it'll be like later on when cars have telephones and television, too. A guy's driving along. His wife calls up and says, honey, bring home a head of lettuce, some carrots, a cucumber, and get that tomato out of your car.
Washington, D.C. The greatest ovation in the history of the nation's capital greeted President Truman as a crowd of 750,000 cheered his triumphant return to the White House.
Yes, sir, it was at a reception. From every window, they were throwing confetti and old cabinet members. And the world will long remember President Truman's historic words when he returned to the White House. He said, it's okay, Bess, you can send the laundry out now. When Harry got back to the White House, he started hanging up his coat. Governor Warren stuck his head out of the closet and said, I'll be out of your way as soon as I pack up my oranges. The Democrats did so well in that election, they're even coming out with new products named after the president. They got a new thing now called the Harry Truman Popsicle. It's a frozen Republican on a stick. And with the election coming out the way it did, a lot of people had to change their plans. Now Margaret Truman has to go back to the White House, and she had it all set to be the fourth Andrew sister. The three candidates have really changed their tune since the election. Truman's changed from Missouri Waltz to It's Magic. Dewey's humming Say It Isn't So, and Wallace is singing On a Slow Boat to China. The gal who was selected as the Orchid Queen of the National Flower Festival, our singing orchid, Miss Doris Day.
Every day I love you just a little bit more, just a little bit more, a little bit more. Every day I want you just a little bit more than I did the day before. You'll never guess how deep my love is, not even in your wildest dream. But just so you get it clear, compared to my love, my dear, the Mississippi River's just a stream. Just a little bit more, just a little bit more, a little bit more. Every day I want you just a little bit more than I did the day before. Than I did,
than I did
the day
Downey, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, you probably read in the papers last week that while making a picture at Paramount, Bob Hope tripped and tore a muscle in his right leg. Now let's look behind the scenes and see how an accident like this affects the motion picture industry. We take you to the production offices at Paramount, where the heads of the studio, Henry Geeksberg and Y. Free Frankman, are talking.
Say, YF.
Yes, H.G.?
I've been thinking. We've got a lot of money tied up in that character, Bob Hope. And if his leg doesn't get any better, he may never be in another Paramount picture. How could a thing like that happen to us?
Oh, I don't know. Just lucky, I guess.
But YF, what'll we do about Hope? His leg may be broken.
Yeah, too bad he ain't Trigger. We could shoot him.
You know how this accident happened, don't you, YF? Hope was doing that boat scene, and as he tried to get on board, he slipped and fell because somebody had put grease all over the gangplank. You know, it looks like someone is out to get him.
Yeah. Now remember, H.G., if there's an investigation, we're in this thing together.
Well, it seemed like the easy way. And while we're on the subject, YF, we got to get rid of a lot of the actors over here. They're getting too old.
Yeah, how about that Crosby? Remember when we thought we had mice in the studio? We spent $5,000 to get rid of the mice and then found out it was Crosby's joints that were doing the squeaking.
You know, IF, I think Bing is about the same age as Hope.
Yeah, I know it. If we put them in another road picture, the road's got to be downhill. By the way, where's Hope now?
He's over in his dressing room, resting.
Oh. Oh, Doris, this pain is awful.
Oh, is it really that bad, Bob? Let me look at your leg. Oh, my gosh, it's all twisted out of shape, isn't it?
That's the wrong leg.
Oh, gee, Bob, I hate to see you in such misery. Does it hurt much?
Well, I don't care about that. I just wish it had been my other knee.
Why?
Well, the knee I hurt is the one with the dimple in it. Now, I'll never be able to wear my pedal pushers with a split up the side.
Bob, I just don't understand how a thing like this could happen to you. You're so strong and husky.
Am I?
Yeah, and so loaded with vitality.
Honest?
Sure. Why, I always think of you as being a real He-Man.
You do?
Yes.
I have so much more than Gregory. Why should I fight it? Say, it was sure nice of you to drop in, though, Doris. I want to...
Hello, Doris. Hello, Mr. Hope.
Oh, hello, Miss Ryan.
Hello, Miss Ryan. How do you feel today?
Well, you know me. I always try to keep my chin up, even though my arches are falling. I heard about what happened to Mr. Hope, and I thought I'd come over and cheer him up.
Oh, thanks. You see, I hurt my leg, and I can't move it. It's nothing to worry about.
Oh, I don't know about that. My Uncle Julius had the same thing once in his shoulders. And he couldn't move his arms. The doctor made him leave them in one position.
Oh, that must have been terrible.
Well, it worked out all right. When he died 2 days later, his arms were already folded on his chest.
That's nice. Portia faces life. This gal backs into it.
Bob, you should listen to Miss Ryan. She can help you. She's been through a lot of these things, you know.
Oh, yes. I've never really been all well all my life. That is all of it, you know. And recently, Mr. Hope, it's been much worse. Yesterday, I thought I was losing my mind. All day long, I kept hearing voices in my head.
You were hearing voices in your head?
Yes, but I found out what it was. The battery in my hearing aid was low, and I was still getting the election returns.
Well, don't worry. Hoover made it, you know. But it was nice of you to drop in, Miss Ryan.
Well, I do hope you get better. Oh, that reminds me, before I go, I wanted to show you a picture of my Uncle Julius, the one who died.
Well, what do I want to see a picture of him for?
Well, you might get worse. And if you don't pull through, it'll be nice if you know somebody when you get there. Keep your chin up now. Bye.
Thanks. If she ever gets married, she'll spend her honeymoon in the window of the Rexall drugstore.
Well, I have to be running along too, Bob. I promised High Averback I'd meet him. He's making a screen test over here.
Averback is making a screen test? You mean they've run out of talent?
Well, I think High will do very well in pictures because he just tests...
Oh, hello, everybody. Hello, Doris.
Oh, hello, High. Are you all ready for your screen test?
Yes, Doris. I just came from the makeup department.
They didn't get your ears on straight.
At least my lobes are on the bottom. Well, now, Doris, how about running through the screen test with me like you promised?
Okay, hand me the script.
Yeah, now, the scene we're doing takes place in a New York penthouse. We're social leaders and we're married, but we're splitting up. Now, you have the first line, and I want you to pay close attention to my diction.
Montgomery, I'm afraid that you and I are through. It's regrettable, but we can't go on.
Yes, Alice. I'm so sorry that we must split... But I'm afraid we must go our separate ways.
Don't you think you're carrying too many pounds of pressure there? Here's our junior crooner we borrowed from the Oasis this week.
The 19-year-old Bill Farrell, ladies and gentlemen.
There is no verse to this song, 'cause I don't want to wait a moment too long to say that I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers weeping on the faraway shore. Out on the briny, with the moon big and shiny, mailing your heart of stone. Yes, I want to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. On a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. On a real slow boat,
on a real slow boat,
on a slow, slow boat to China.
Cleveland, Billy Farrell. Thank you very much. Singing Slow Boat to China. Now, tonight, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to present a very different kind of a thing here. We have a thing here. Musicians, please, no tuning while the star is on, please. Now, as I was saying, please. Hey, Evelyn, stop with that magic violin.
I resent that.
Well, Jack Benny, ladies and gentlemen. Jack, what are you doing here?
Some surprise. We rehearsed 9 weeks already.
Bob, look, I heard about your leg, and I thought I'd pay you a visit.
Well, that's swell of you, Jack, but how come you're sitting in with Les Brown's orchestra?
Well, just once I wanted to play in a band and not worry about the leader's breath taking the varnish off my violin.
You don't have to worry about Les. Les hasn't been high since Petrillo picked him up to burp him. But look, it was awfully nice of you to drop in to see me, Jack.
Well, I was sorry to hear about your accident, Bob.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable, but the worst of it is whenever I hobble down the street, people keep throwing money in my hat.
They do?
Gosh, how embarrassing. That's terrible. That must be awful.
Bob, how much do you average a block?
Oh, it varies. But take my advice, Jack. Stay away from Beverly Hills. Nothing but Dewey buttons. But I can't get over how nice it is of you to drop in on me, Jack.
Well, Bob, that's the way it is with us troopers. You know, we show people have to stick together in these times of trouble. Why, as soon as I heard of your accident, I rushed right over here to be the first one at your side.
Jack, you came over just to help me?
Well, yes. Of course, if you buy the insurance policy I have in mind, it helps me a little, too. You know?
Jack, why are you selling insurance?
Well, you see, it's a little early to start unloading my line of Christmas cards.
Well, Jack, I don't get this. You're a wealthy man. You're worth millions of dollars.
Whoops.
Selling insurance, huh? Well, have you got a sample policy you can show me there in your portfolio? Jack, did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear anything.
You sure you didn't hear that echo?
No, kid, this is your show.
Well, look, Jack, let's face it, this is ridiculous. You don't have to sell insurance, you're a star. They write about you in the Saturday Evening Post. You're one of the outstanding comedians in show business. One of them. You don't mind me throwing that in there, do you?
No.
No, this is still your show.
No, but you're really great, Jack. People stay at home on Sundays just to listen to your radio show.
I have so much more than Fred Allen. Why should I fight?
Say, wait a minute. That's my gag.
I'll trade you for the yodel.
What'll my sponsor say?
Well, I swan.
Me too.
Yes, sir.
Bye, Cracky.
That's right.
Wait a minute.
Gee whiz.
My goodness.
Of course.
And how?
Wait a minute.
I'll say.
Hurry up.
You bet.
Hoo-ha.
Wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
Bye, Cracky.
Wait a minute!
Easy, Jack. Either we peddle the stuff this way or I have to put on a pair of water wings and sell it bathtub to bathtub.
My next line is a humdinger. Wait a minute. Bathtub to bathtub, huh? I have trouble with my sponsor, too. That's a dandy line. Thanks, Bob. I rehearsed 4 weeks for that line.
Well, we were going to give you something you could get your teeth into, but we weren't sure you'd have them with you tonight.
You wouldn't dare say that if you were still with Pepsodent, brother. You coward.
Let's get back to this stuff, huh?
We'll never get through with this tonight. Look at. You know, Bob, you know who has
Stand
the
by,
sweetest...
Fibber.
You know who has the sweetest... Page 15. You know who has the sweetest...
I'm not...
You know who has the sweet... Never get off.
Wait a
you know
minute.
Who has... I want to play the violin yet. Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Are we still on?
You know okay. Who has the sweetest racket radio, don't you? The disc jockeys.
Disc jockeys. You mean one of those guys who says, this next record is sponsored by the Happy Hunting Ground Funeral Home, and now the orchestra plays, he's a real gone guy?
We haven't got time to wait
See,
for
See, why
that.
Don't we try... Please, your laughs, not mine. Please. Say, why don't we try our hand at being disc jockey, Jack? All we have to do is make the rounds of the music shops and pick up a couple of 100 records.
Well, I don't know.
For free.
Shoot the wax to me, Max.
We'd be great as a team of disc jockeys. As you say in radio, I can just hear it now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to station SLOB, the biggest on the coast. And now we present Jazzy Jack Benny and Bebop Bob in their original radio record show, Make Believe Washroom.
Hiya, gang. Hiya, Jazz. This is your old disc jockey, Bebop Bob, with another knocked-out record section. It's all on wax, and it's real mad. So you kids who want to get your kicks, lace up your boots and latch on to some of this frantic jive that we're going to send swinging your way. Right now, cats, I'd like to turn the mic over to a real hep character, the man who knows all the answers in the world of jazz, that solid jet, my platter partner, Jazzy Jack Benny.
Hacha Bodio Do.
Solid, Jack. And now, before we spin our next platter for you kids, we'd like to tell you the next minute half of our show is sponsored by Dr. Capstaff's weight reducing plan.
We'd like a word with those of you ladies who weigh over 400 pounds. Do you have the feeling that you're being followed? You are. It's you.
And you've met over 400 pounds. You have large stomachs. When you get your shoes shined, you have to take the bootblack's word for it.
Why not try Dr. Capstaff's weight-reducing pill?
Yes, to take off those extra pounds, try Dr. Capstaff's method. No diet, no pills, no injections, no exercise. Once a week, Dr. Capstaff comes to your house and beats you with a rubber hose. And now we're going to play our first record. It's a little tune called I'm Dancing with Tears in My Eyes because the girl in my arms had onions for dinner.
It's going to be played by Woody Gribbiness and As You Should Live So Long if you can find the melody orchestra. Hit it, Woody.
Ah, thanks, Woody. That was great.
Look, Bebop, a bunch of new releases just arrived.
Gee, there's some interesting titles. Look at this one. You used to be the cream in my coffee, but now you're just grounds for divorce.
Get a load of this one. If you were the only girl in the world and I was the only boy, I wonder who I'd play handball with at the Y.
Here's my favorite. Hair of gold, eyes of blue, lips like cherry wine. I never should have stomped on them with my bare feet. Say, suppose we play that one right now.
Okay, but first, a word from our sponsor.
Yes, this next record is coming to you through the courtesy of Slushies, the only breakfast cereal that's shot out of a water pistol.
Folks, you'll just love Slushies. They don't snap, crackle, and pop like other breakfast cereals. They just lie there anew.
Mothers, you would cheer when you see the way your kids dive into a bowl of Slushies. They never come up again. Listen to what one happy user of slushies has to say.
I've been eating slushies for nigh on to 30 years. And I want to tell you something, I'm getting mighty tired.
Thank you, Effie Spoon of Battle Creek, Michigan. Say, Jack, what's next on the turntable?
Oh, the folks will just love this one.
Yes, sir. It's a new release that features a duet by the brilliant young Waukegan violinist, Benny Kabelski.
And that new Cleveland singing discovery, the Velvet Smog.
Okay, should we give it a word?
Yeah.
Oh, east is east, and west is west, and the wrong one I have chose. Let's go where you keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows. Rings and things and buttons and bows. Don't bury me in this prairie, take me where the cement grows. Let's move out to some big town where they love a gal by the cut of her clothes. And you'll stand out in buttons and bows.
No practicing on our time, please.
I love you in buckskin skirt that you won't stun, but I love you longer, stronger, where your friends don't know the gun. Now's the buckboard bounce and a cactus hurts my tears. Let's bamboos where gals keep using those silks and satins and linen that shows, and you're all mine in buttons and bows.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you so much. You've been fine. That's fine, Jack. Thank you. Next week, ladies and gentlemen... Jack, wait a minute, Jack. We have next week. It's all over, kids. Pack up. Okay. We have another... Next week, we have Morton Downey, ladies and gentlemen. That Coca... Say, okay, Jack, wait a minute. It's all over, Jack. Jack, wait a minute! Wait a minute!
For the memory of the vote in 48, a chance to demonstrate whom we endorse to chart the course of our U.S. ship of state.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to pay a tribute to that fighting man from Missouri who stepped into the ring last Tuesday with the odds against him and came out the winner and still champion of the USA, President Harry S. Truman.
From November of 1948, it's been The Bob Hope Show with special guest star Jack Benny. In a moment... William Gargan starring in Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator, with Blood Money, as this edition of Yesteryear continues.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear. Here's Craig Roberts.
Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator, is one of the few detective radio series that had separate versions of it broadcast from both coasts. NBC produced the program from its New York studios from 1951 through early 1954, then moved the program to Hollywood, California, where it aired from 1954 through the end of the 1955 season. William Gargan, who also played the better-known television and radio detective Martin Kane, was the voice of New York private eye Barry Craig, while Ralph Bell portrayed his associate, Lieutenant Travis Rogers. Return with us now to those exciting days of yesteryear with William Gargan starring in Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator, and The Case of Blood Money from August of 1954. Another classic program from the radio vault of yesteryear.
William Gargan stars as Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator.
Overexertion can be dangerous, folks, but no exercise at all is even worse. Complete inactivity can only mean you're either muscle-bound or dead.
The National Broadcasting Company presents William Gargan in another transcribed drama of mystery and adventure with America's number one detective, Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator.
Craig speaking. Every profession has its system of reciprocal favors among colleagues. A doctor consults a fellow practitioner. Lawyers put their heads together. And even private police operatives requisition each other's time and brain power. The colleague and competitor who sought my aid one fine day was a chap named Max Marcy. Marcy operated a one-man investigation agency a half mile from the dump I call my own. Not too young, Marcy. Long in years. Ready for retirement, but too poor to afford it.
I'm 35 years in the business, Craig. I'm afraid there's only one way I know of to quit.
Feet first, huh?
In a pine box, yes.
What keeps you coppering, Max, when you could be riding a rocking chair?
The same thing that started me working 3 decades ago.
Food, shelter, and the high cost of government?
A livelihood, yes.
Nothing socked away, Max?
Oh, maybe $500 in war bonds.
Not much for a lifetime in harness.
You know, there's an old axiom, Craig.
Yeah, it's up there on my wall, reading cops die broke.
Work for me, Craig.
On what?
The man I frankly find impossible to locate. For 3 weeks now, I've used every trick I know, every avenue.
His name?
Anatole Barber. The only clue I have is that he was once a rug dealer.
A rug dealer?
Oriental rugs. 15 years ago, he had a store on 3rd Avenue.
Cold trail, huh?
Cold like ice.
Who assigned you to look for Anatole Barber?
That information is confidential.
I understand. Client doesn't want his name bandied about. So you're really stuck, huh, Max?
Oh, not so much stuck as...
As?
Sick. Exhausted. I don't have the old strength. You know, the machine runs down. This coming October, I'm 64, Craig.
Then why not just dump a tough case? Why aggravate yourself?
$2,000. Who can dump $2,000?
No cop I know.
Find Anatole, Barber. I'll split with you.
Uh-uh. The fee's all yours. I'll just tap you for expenses. Barber, a one-time rug dealer. You've, of course, got a full description of him.
Even a photograph. Oh, Craig, I don't know how to thank you.
I'm not doing it for you, Max. I'm really doing it for me. I look at you and I see me. Me a quarter of a century hence. I'm out asking a younger cop to help me stay in business. One cop runs into a blank wall. Another cop finds a door through the wall. The luck of the game. What was tough for Max Marcy was easy for me, as it turned out. An ex-Oriental rug dealer is a member of a clan. The tricky science of rugs limits the colony of dealers to a small, tight elite. One big family of operators, so to speak. My information on Anatole Barber came from a gentleman named Amar Serebi.
Yes, Anatole Barber is well known to me.
Under which rug is he hiding?
For a long time now, Anatole is not in our trade.
He had a store on Upper 3rd Avenue some 15 years ago, I hear.
Yes, the Mecca Bazaar. He was the cleverest trader of all of us, Anatole.
But he folded his tent.
Why he gave up his business, nobody knows.
You make it sound mystifying.
Fine Oriental rugs are more than a business, Mr. Craig. They are a culture and a passion. I might even say a cult. It is in our blood.
Now, really enlighten me, huh? Where can I find your renegade colleague, Anatole Barber?
He lives in Sackett Bay.
Sackett Bay out in Long Island?
Yes. He's using his mother's name now, Belmar. His mother was English.
Anatole Belmar?
Yes.
Tell me, how is it you have Anatole Barber Belmar's whereabouts at your fingertips?
We have a trade association. I am corresponding secretary. Even though Anatole is retired from our trade, he has faithfully kept up his dues.
I see. Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Serebi.
I've been privileged. You are perhaps interested in a fine Bokhara rug at a great sacrifice price.
Mr. Serebi, please, let go of my coat lapels. I phoned Max Marcy the good news. Hello, Max.
Yes, Craig?
That $2,000 fee, start spending it.
You found Anatole Barber?
Anatole Barber Belmar. He's using his mother's maiden name. Lives out in Sackett Bay. 30 miles out in Long Island, Max.
Craig, I'm at a loss for words. Why, it's hardly been 12 hours.
No bouquets, Max. It happens. The brakes. I got the brakes. Okay for me to follow through in Sackett Bay?
Just to verify his presence there, how he's established. Craig, don't alarm the man into flight.
I'll pose as a door-to-door salesman. Max, don't worry.
Telephone me from Sackett Bay.
Will do. So long. At Sackett Bay, Long Island, the guy with blue freckles in the general store told me where to find Anatole Belmont. On an island a half mile off the mainland. Anatole B. was known around Sackett Bay as the recluse type. The gent with a black patch over his eye ferried me to Belmar's Island. He drove the leaky motorboat like a suicide, as many knots an hour as he had kinks in his brain. Hey, Buster, slow down. Hey, Buster, I'm two premiums behind in my insurance. I went. Either a deaf mute or not to talk in time. I found a suitable prayer and began to mumble it. Belmar's Island had overstuffed seagulls on it the size of vultures. It also had a shack. A shack put together with paper, paste, and wire. I knocked politely. Anatole Belmar? No answer. I did the impolite thing. I just walked in. Inside, I again did the polite thing. I removed my hat. You generally do if you've got visiting manners. You even make a special point of remembering to remove your hat in the presence of the dead. How dead was Anatole Belmar? Dead beyond recall. He was hanging by his neck from a beam 8 feet off the floor. I changed my first diagnosis of suicide when I saw the lump on his head. He'd been slugged and strung up by somebody hoping to pass it off as suicide. I had news for the local police, and after that, I had mournful news for Max. Back in Manhattan, USA, I gave Max the mournful news. Funny thing, though, Max wasn't too surprised.
All day today, I anticipated just what you've now told me, Craig.
You guessed I'd find Anatole Barber Belmar dead?
I guessed, yes.
Where do you hide your Ouija board?
I'll explain, but first tell me if you smell something.
Smell? Yeah, smoke. I smell smoke.
Come, I'll show you why. In my file room. Look, Craig.
You've had a fire in here, huh? When, Max?
This morning.
How come the fire was localized to the one room?
Chemical extinguishers. The building porter discovered the fire. He broke down the door and managed to put the fire out.
An incendiary fire, obviously.
Plain as my nose.
And said nose is as plain as an aviation landing strip. I see papers were pulled out of your cabinets, piled on the floor, then a match lit to the pile.
And when I found the fire, I knew at once you'd find Anatole Barber dead.
What's your theory there?
The client who engaged me to find Anatole Barber. I had his signature on a retainer, form I regularly use in my agency every time I take on a case.
So?
I've carefully reconstructed the pattern of the fire. What files were burned, I asked myself. Who'd have some interest in destroying a section of my files?
And you finally fixed on this one client?
The only active account I've had in 6 weeks. His file was among those destroyed.
Well, that's a bit arbitrary as a conclusion, Max.
And not so arbitrary when you're related to the murder of Anatole Barber. It's a fact, Craig. The purpose in engaging me was to find Anatole Barber Belmar so he could be murdered. And the trick with my files was to erase every clue there could be to the murderer.
The murderer being the man who engaged you in the first place?
Yes.
What was the signature on that retainer form?
Alan Merritt.
A traceable signature, no doubt. Cinch for a cop to find in some public record. That's why he had to recover it, destroy it.
Yes.
And the fire was set to confuse matters as a cover-up. Alias Alan Merritt. What does he look like, Max?
Oh, like anybody. Nothing distinctive to his appearance. His average in height, build, complexion, dress, speech.
Oh, great. What reason did he give you for wanting you to round up Anatole Barber?
Barber owed him $10,000 from an old business investment. He wanted to locate Barber so he could file a civil suit.
A fish story.
A lie, yes. Surely a lie.
Max.
Yes, Craig.
The sad truth is, in finding Anatole Barber, you gave an unwitting assist to a murder. Also, to give credit where credit is due, so alas did I.
We were fingermen.
One other thing, Max.
What?
This alias Alan Merritt, even with the traceable signature on that retainer form no longer worrying him, he's still got a loose thread dangling. A thread that can become a hangman's noose.
What thread?
You two ever come face to face, you can identify him.
I can, yes.
Are you reading my mind, Max?
Yes. This alias Alan Merritt, to really be safe, he must also kill me.
That chance meeting face to face, somewhere, sometime, fate's little irony. Your client must right now be fretting over it. He'll try to kill you, Max, and that puts us right back in business.
Or puts me in a grave.
To get at you, he's got to show himself. He shows himself, and I nab him.
Craig.
What, Max?
After you make the arrest, please see that Max Marcy gets a decent burial.
A hearse drawn by 16 prancing chorus girls, Max. I make you that promise. In due time, the attempted murder of Max Marcy, Private Eye, came to pass. On a quiet street in the noonday sun, Max leaning conspicuously against the store window reading a newspaper, and yours truly deployed across the street, waiting and watching. The attempt came like a clap of thunder from the sky. Max was just a wee bit hysterical.
Craig, look how close the bullet came. Here, see the crown of my hat.
A hair singe is beneficial, Max. Helps prevent premature baldness.
Craig, don't joke.
If I didn't joke, I'd cry.
He escaped you?
Totally. He was staked out somewhere on one of the roofs. On that, frankly, I never figured.
Now what?
Well, we line up a second try at you. I'll have the roofs covered this time. All the men Lieutenant Trav Rogers over at police headquarters can spare. Sorry to do this to you, Max. The unfortunate thing about murder is you can't always predict where and when it will take place. We had cops staked out on roofs, Max sunning himself on the open street every day for a week. But when the second attempt on Max finally came, it came out of left field. It was in Max's office. In the afternoon heat, summer heat that dehydrated you every 10 minutes. I watched Max idle over to his filtered water cooler. I watched Max pour himself a drink. 10 seconds later, I watched Max turn colors.
Craig.
Max, what's wrong?
Craig, I'm poisoned.
Max. Poison in the water cooler, but not enough to kill, luckily. In the hospital 6 hours later, Max managed a whispered conversation.
Craig.
Yes, Max.
1, 2 attempts. Number 3.
Ah, superstition. Fatalistic talk. Think of it this way. 2 strikes so far. Strike 3, the killer's out.
How long will I be laid up?
Overnight. You got a mild dose. Only enough to give you stomach cramps.
It's hopeless, Craig. Alias Alan Merritt would even more in the dark. Better to give up.
He's shrewd and slippery, our alias Alan Merritt. But I'll find an avenue to him. From here on, I'm going all out, Max. For utter lack of a lead, I did next best to the aimless thing. I stopped in to admire Oriental carpets in the shop of my original contact, Amar Serebi.
Yes, I have heard the sorrowful news.
Police check disclosed no next of kin, no relatives.
Anatole Barber was alone in the world.
How about best friends?
Anatole Barber turned friendships away. He was suspicious and secretive.
How about lady friends?
Ladies? No, I do not think.
Oh, come on. Even a suspicious and secretive recluse has some male ego. Some passing interest in the opposite sex.
There was a woman. Oh, but such a long time ago.
What was her name?
Madame Nila Gallard.
Know where I can find her?
Nobody has seen Nila Gallard for 8-10 years.
How close was she to Anatole Barber?
All I know to say, she worked in his store, the Mecca Bazaar. They would work together, take their meals together.
Sounds chummy enough. Say, Serebi.
Yes?
Anatole Barber's burial. The police have it scheduled for the day after tomorrow. A Potter's Field burial under the auspices of the city.
Oh, this is regrettable. I shall see that the association extends the honors due him. That is to say, pays the bills for the funeral.
Well, that's fine, but keep that quiet. What I want you to do is spread the word around that a kinsman's being given an obscure pauper's burial. Create sentiment and sympathy. Make old friends and business associates want to pay their last respects. Give Anatole Barber a decent send-off.
You think Nila Gallard will hear this and come to the funeral? Huh?
I hope Nila Gallard will put in an appearance. Funerals are sad. But to me, this one was a joy. I was all smiles when Amar Serebi whispered the magic words into my ear.
That woman standing there, wearing the black veil, she is Madame Nila Gallard.
Some hours later, I took tea with Madame Gallard. Her home is a frame dwelling in suburban New Jersey.
A middle-aged woman, once beautiful, you could tell. But heavy lines in her face now, like she'd known troubled times.
I knew it was a mistake to come to Anatole's burial.
Now look, you're a dignified woman, so let's do this with dignity. Don't make me talk like a bad-mannered cop.
I have a sealed envelope given to me by Anatole Barber. I have kept it unopened for 15 years.
He wanted it kept unopened?
Yes, he was afraid. Afraid of what in the end was his fate.
Murder?
Murder. Here's the letter. On the envelope, you will see Anatole's own handwriting.
To be opened only in case of my death. You're in the total dark, making blind circles, and then a bar of clear daylight knifes through the blackout. Suddenly, you're in the know. I let Max Marcy in on the contents of the letter left with Madame Gallant.
Oh, you're a bloodhound, Craig.
You keep moving and hoping. You've sooner or later got the spark. Anatole Barber spells out his secret in this letter.
Blackmail.
15 years of it. Anatole Barber had been blackmailing an important social figure named Wynne Blake.
Wynne Blake? Well, that's very hard to believe. That man is one of 50 best-known people in the world.
In the letter, Anatole sounds a fatalistic note. Right in your style, Max.
He expected to sooner or later be murdered.
The blackmailer's chronic anxiety. They figure the worm has to turn. The sucker must finally strike back.
Craig.
Yes, Max.
What's your attitude at this point?
Meaning?
Oh, don't misunderstand me, Craig, please, but...
But? You can speak out openly, Max.
Well, do I motivate decisions from now on, or do you?
Meaning it was your case originally?
There are these new ramifications. A lot of it, none of our business as private operatives. Then a man like this Wynne Blake, a figure his size, we bungle handling it somewhere, it could blow up in our faces.
Come down to what's bothering you, Max.
All right. Frankly, is it any of our business now?
It's my business, Max. You can scare off and quit. Figure the angles and decide there's no dough anywhere in it. Only headaches and risks. But don't please decide for me. Murder and blackmail is a public business, and while I'm a private investigator, I'm also a public citizen.
You're pretty good at speeches, too. All right, forget I said anything. Do what you have to do.
What I had to do was go see Wynne Blake, which I did. The Blake house was not only upper class, it was the top story of the upper class. And the guy who wielded the scepter in the palace looked every inch his role in life. Gray, distinguished, with a stiff, aristocratic spine. A polished surface veneer with only one thing marring it. His eyes. I'd never seen sadder eyes.
I wondered when it would be that a man just like yourself, a detective, would come to Blake Manor.
You've been wondering that nightmare for 15 years.
Yes, for 15 years. The ordeal of it, sir, the eternal apprehension.
The ghost in your closet clanking his chains.
And these days since the death of Anatole Barber, I've barely weathered them.
Remorse?
I'm not surprised at the innuendo. I rather expected it.
Who else would care to murder Anatole Barber?
I have no answer to that.
Barber, a leech who's been blackmailing you for 15 years.
But I paid his every demand all these years. Why then now would I want to do violence to the man?
I've got a simple answer to that. You just couldn't find Barber to kill him.
I did not murder or cause the murder of Anatole Barber.
What was he blackmailing you for? What did he have on you?
Without legal counsel, I'm not sure I... All right, I'll tell you. I was involved in an accident in the summer of 1939.
Automobile accident?
Yes. A late hour in the driving rain, very little visibility. It was on a downtown street. I struck and killed an elderly pedestrian.
Hit and run, huh?
I'm ready now to face the charges, but I was coward enough and fool enough to drive away. I let my panic override my better judgment, my more decent instincts. You see,
you had a lot to lose, you figured. You didn't want a vehicular homicide against you.
I just drove away.
But not unnoticed and undetected, as you believed then. Somebody saw the accident, jotted down your license plate number.
Anatole Barber.
Mm-hmm.
He operated a store where the accident occurred, a rug shop, the Mecca Bazaar. He saw everything through his store window.
And he's bled you ever since. He promptly closed up shop and made you his chief business from then on, huh?
He extorted a fortune from me in these 15 years.
When did he tap you last?
2 weeks before he died.
How much did you give him?
The usual periodic $10,000 in cash.
I left the money in a designated place, as I always did. Barber never showed himself personally. He wasn't taking any chances. Did you hire a private detective to locate Anatole Barber's whereabouts for you?
I did not.
No, huh? Anybody else in your family aware of your predicament with Anatole Barber?
My wife knew, and so does my son.
Your wife knew, you say?
My wife is dead.
Oh. And your son, where is he?
He lives away at his school.
What's the school?
Eagle University, a medical college. Stuart's in the senior class. But my son couldn't possibly have anything...
How can you be sure?
I suppose I cannot be sure.
Son trying to get his pop out of a situation. Son nervy enough to commit the murder his father shrinks from doing. Wynn Blake or the son Stuart Blake? I ask you, who else would want to murder Anatole Barber? And so Barry Craig went to college. The college dormitory room is only a box built around silver loving cups, souvenir banners, and pin-ups of Jane Russell.
Barber was vermin. Murder was too merciful for him. Ask me, he deserved 15 years of some insidious oriental torture.
Did you kill him?
Did I what?
Murder Anatole Barber.
Yeah. Yeah, sure I did. He had it coming, and I gave it to him.
Nice try, sonny.
Try?
Try at taking the heat off your father.
My father? Look, Dad hasn't got the moxie for the job done on Anatole Barber.
But you have, huh?
I say I killed him, so let's not beat that question around anymore.
Okay, we'll bypass that question for the time being. Now answer me this, and truthfully. Did you hire a private detective to track down Barber?
I hired Max Marcier. Do you doubt that, too?
Well, proof could help.
Proof, huh? Sure. Sure, wait a second. Here. Here's your proof.
A receipt.
That's right, for $300, a retainer initialed M.M. My down payment to Max Marcy for his services.
There was a statue in bronze on the college campus steps, General somebody or other. It was almost a second statue unveiled there about the time I was leaving. Statue of yours truly, stiff in the joints with an undertaker's glaze on top. A shot that froze me, but didn't chill me. I was marked for murder. I had the case wrapped up, and the killer knew it. I brought Max Marcy up to date.
The son is plainly lying to protect the father.
That's my thought.
Arrest the father. Under arrest, he'll confess.
To keep the boy honest, huh?
To let the son take his, the father's blame. That's the ultimate cowardice. It's unthinkable. No decent father would.
You're right there, no doubt. I swiped a photograph of the son off his bureau top. This, Max. Handsome kid, huh?
Yes, strapping.
Nothing average about his looks, huh, Max? Way above average in height, size. Very distinguished looking, generally. Crew cut. A break in the beak of his nose.
An unusual looking boy, yes.
That admission, Max, kind of gives you the lie.
The lie? Oh, you mean my description of alias Alan Merritt, do you?
Yeah. Your nothing description of a man you invented. The big lie you told me. I've just remarked on the glaring flaw in your almost perfect scheme, Max.
Scheme?
Crime.
You're accusing me?
Of beating my time to Sackett Bay. Of murdering Anatole Barber before I got there. I found Barber for you. You did the rest.
But, Craig, consider all the facts.
Facts, huh? Facts like the phony fire you set yourself... Or the hood you hired to climb a roof and shoot at you? Or the modest dose of insect poison you deliberately poured yourself from the water cooler? All to blind me to your guilt? Or maybe the fact that you tried to kill me today on the campus steps of Eagle University?
You are full of ideas, my good friend.
Yeah, I am. How much dough have you got sorted away now, Max?
I'm penniless.
Was. Until you found that gold mine of cash in Barber's shack. The fortune you knew he'd accumulated by blackmailing Wynn Blake for 15 years. You really tried providing for your old age, colleague.
Words, accusations, talk, you'll need proof.
I know. A tough old bird like you, it will need an army of cops to find that fortune you swiped and stashed away. Sure, proof's going to be tough. But let's start it going officially, huh?
You're arresting me?
Arresting and charging you. From there on, it's up to the regular police. I've personally gone as far as I care to go.
You're sentimental about me.
No, Max. Not a bit sentimental. Just fed up and bored. You're kind of creep I'd rather read about you in the papers. Why knock myself out? Walk ahead of me, Max.
You have been listening to William Gargan in another exciting transcribed mystery drama from the adventures of Barry Craig, confidential investigator. Tonight's story, Blood Money, was written by John Robert. Next week, our story is titled, Hay is for Homicide, about which Barry Craig has this to say.
Next week's story is titled, Hay is for Homicide. And the reason for this has something to do with a hayride and a farmer's daughter. With that combination, how could it help being murder? Good night, folks. See you next week.
The National Broadcasting Company has just brought you an NBC Radio Network production with William Gargan, starring as Barry Craig, confidential investigator, and directed by Arthur Jacobson. Also heard were Jim Nusser, Marvin Miller, Betty Lou Gerson, Jack Moyles, and Paul Richards. John Lang speaking.
From August of 1954, it's been Barry Craig, investigator, with Blood Money. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this edition of Yesteryear, but make it a point to join us again next week, and why not tell a friend to tune in too, and enjoy more great moments from the golden age of radio. I'm Craig Roberts with those exciting days of yesteryear. Till next time, so long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. Comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show.
Preceding program, copyright Edgewater Productions. All rights reserved.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio, KSSR-DB San Francisco, where the big bands swing.
Thank you.
She's a Latin from Manhattan. You can tell by her manana. She's a Latin from Manhattan and not Havana. Though she does the rumba for us, and she calls herself Dolores. She was in a Broadway chorus known as Susie Donahue. She can take a tambourine and whack it, but with her it's just a racket. She's a hoofer from 10th Avenue. She's a Latin from Manhattan. She's a 42nd Streeter. She's a Latin from Manhattan, Senorita Donahue.
It's your favorite music by your request. Swing Street with Craig Roberts, Mondays at 7 p.m. Pacific on Swing Street Radio, where the big band swings.